Well, it's been a fun week for me here filling in for Celeste Headlee on Second Thought. We talked about the final months of Franklin Roosevelt's life down in Warm Springs. We celebrated music in my city, Macon. And we also talked about the high cost of HIV medication in Atlanta. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and celebrate Friday. Let's head to the break room.
With the iPhone 7, we've done something that at first seems counterintuitive and then is. We've made it worse.
I really don't think I have cancer.
Well, nobody ever thinks they have cancer. The symptoms can take many different forms, such as runny nose, mild cough, stress.
Lies are the new truth. Yes, more than ever, people today are living an entirely fact-free lifestyle.
Joining us in the break room this week are Amy Condon. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. Hey there, Amy.
Hey, how are you doing today?
I'm just lovely. I imagine that Sam Burnham is as well, curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Good to have you with us, Sam.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Tamika DePriest is Senior Director of Communications at Emory University. Thanks for being here, Tamika.
Happy Friday. Glad to be here.
Happy Friday to you. Happy Friday as well to Stefan Turkheimer, is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Adam.
Apple unveiled the iPhone 7 last week. The smartphone, for the most part, looks similar to past models, except for one big thing.
We removed the headphone jack. And that's all. That's the newness right there. It's just the lack of a thing that was there, and now it's not. It's gone. It's not there anymore. Ta-da!
Now, Apple's new earbuds are still going to work if you plug them into the phone's charge port, the lightning port at the bottom. But if you want to charge your phone and listen to stuff at the same time, you're going to need to buy a $40 adapter. Amy, let's start with you. As a fellow journalist, did this give you a little bit of a crisis? Did you have flashes to like needing to do work in the airport and you can't charge your phone and listen at the same time?
I have to admit I'm a laggard when it comes to like new phones, and I let people worry about that stuff. And then I go, oh, okay, then I might adopt it. But if I think it's stupid, I won't adopt it ever. And I'm kind of like, which sounds really judgy. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's not judgy at all. You're letting other people be the leading edge. That's very brave.
Only on certain types of technology.
Okay. Anybody in the Atlanta crew want to defend this?
There's no defending it. I mean, Bluetooth headsets are the worst. Mine drops every 90 seconds. If I wanted to listen to only 2/3 of music, then I would, you know, listen to the radio.
Yeah.
I really liked what Ricky Bevington said about it. It looked like you had the electric toothbrush head stuck in your ear.
Oh, my God.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I'm just planning to get more usage out of my iPhone 6. I mean, I'll just be honest. And like Amy, I would let the early adopters sort of work out the kinks on iPhone 7. But I am looking forward to the whole water-resistant feature. So maybe I'll get on board with 7S.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. All I know
is 14.
I had to buy an audio interface for my phone this week, and back in the day, it was just a $40 thing that plugged into the headphone jack. But then I was thinking that's not a good investment right now because I'm gonna have a 7 in like a year. So I spent $130 on a lightning-based interface, and I just want to hurt someone. But anyway,
let's just move on. Phones used to have microphones included in them, and you could speak into them. You didn't have to buy an audio thing. Sorry.
Right.
Well, I need a thing for an external microphone because I'm a radio guy. Leave me alone. Anyways, let's talk about something that actually matters. Let's talk about diversity in Georgia. For years, the Atlanta suburb of Norcross was a predominantly white area, but now whites make up less than 20% of the total population. Hispanics are the majority. This week, the Boston Globe, of all places, profiled 7 white residents of Norcross who've struggled to adjust to this rapid demographic shift in their community. It's not the first time that a major out-of-state news outlet has jumped on this story. Atlanta crew, why do we think that this little Atlanta bedroom community is suddenly so interesting to the rest of the country?
Honestly, I think it's because the Boston Globe didn't want to look at the suburbs of Boston for their Trump supporters that were not very friendly towards new immigrants. And they were like, oh, where can we make a cartoon? Let's go to the South and find, various Trump supporters who are not from Massachusetts. I mean, like, Trump got 38% of our primary, 57% of the Massachusetts primary, and yet somehow they had to travel, 1,500 miles to find a Trump supporter. Amazing. Well done. Journalism.
Amy Condon, the editor in the group, do you agree with that criticism?
I think that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I do often find it interesting that when they need a caricature of something, especially national or larger publications, they do turn to the South to find it.
That'll happen. Yeah. Sam?
Yeah, that, I think that has a lot to do with it. We don't talk about the problems elsewhere as much. It's always racism in the South.
Well, I sort of am thinking about it from a slightly different perspective, and that is sort of the Browning of America, right? And so I thought about Norcross as sort of this microcosm of what is sort of happening to the U.S.
And it is a very dramatic case. I mean, it's not... I mean, I think that everything that everybody is saying here is legitimate, but, like, it is a newsworthy story. The demographic change in this particular municipality, if you look at it on its own, is one of the most dramatic, I think, depending on how you count it, the most dramatic in the country in recent years.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that's absolutely true. But at the same time, they didn't use Norcross for what it was. I mean, they used it for that point. I mean, like, for instance, they made this big deal about the Dairy Queen closing. There's a Dairy Queen, like, half a block from there. It's just got a grill attached to it. You know, they have coffee shops. There's a downtown Lilburn. If you read that article, you get the impression that Lilburn was all used car lots. And that's sort of the problem. It's they decided that they wanted Lilburn to be this other thing to make their point, as opposed to, and I'm sure all of her reporting was fine. It's just the lack of reporting. There was not a whole story about Lilburn. There was a story about one aspect of Lilburn. I don't think that's exactly fair.
Tamika, I interrupted you.
No, I just, I think the dynamics are interesting in terms of the reporting. But I do think that some of the undercurrents that are in the story provide fodder for things that we have to think about going forward based on the Browning of America.
What would the number one thing be?
Good question. The number one thing would be, I'll go back to Sam's point of view, which is, you know, racism. More conversation around sort of how we can build bridges.
All right. We're talking about the week's news with The Break Room here on Second Thought, and we'll move on to a decidedly, I was going to say a lighthearted topic, but then I was trying to make like a medical pun, and I just couldn't do it. And just moving on. Websites like the Atlanta-based WebMD, did you know, is based in Atlanta. These websites can be very useful for a lot of people to find some quick medical information, but some of us can take that medical advice a little bit too far.
Hi, I'm Dr. WebMD.
What is it, Doc?
You have cancer.
How could you possibly know that?
Oh, I tell everyone they have cancer. Why? What seems to be the problem, besides the cancer?
Experts in the medical community have coined a new phrase for people who consistently overdiagnose their own medical symptoms. They call it cyberchondria, play on hyperchondria. It happens when somebody looks at a list of maladies and just assumes that they have one of the worst. Any of you guys have a habit of doing this?
I do this. I'm sad. No. I'll just go ahead and admit it. Don't ever look up abdominal pain, because what it needs to do is say, it's 95% chance it's something you ate. Think about what that might have been. But they don't do that. They're just like, meh, you know, it's either a hernia or it's cancer or it's like your bowels were removed. I mean, it's awful.
It's not a tumor.
No, it might be, though.
I know, but everything has cancer associated with it on WebMD, so just don't go there.
Yeah,
agreed. Right. I don't do this myself, but I can honestly see where it's sort of lending credence to people's condition they already have as far as hypochondria. You're already one. Now you have a place you can go and prove that you have some reason to be one.
Well, biscuits give you cancer. Didn't you know that, Sam?
Oh, everything gives you cancer. Just eat the biscuits.
Amy, maybe you'll defend this. I mean, so I wonder if some of the resistance that doctors exhibit towards sites like WebMD is that they don't like that their monopoly on the information, that their status as an exalted priesthood is being threatened by the democratization of this information. Would you back me up on that?
I will to some extent, because I do research on things before I even go to the doctor. and get my list of questions together. And I don't just go to WebMD. I'm like sort of a little nerd that'll read medical journal articles. So I was a caretaker for my mom for a while, and I did that. And the doctors would be like, okay, you seem to have this already figured out. And I'm like, well, no, I just need to know how to proceed here because I'm caring for this person. So I do think that it helps arm patients with more information, and it makes them question things a lot more when they're just sitting there and maybe they're not feeling so well.
That questioning is good, too, because
yeah.
oftentimes I felt like it's a guessing game anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I do think access to this information, at least for me, has put me in a position to ask more questions. Now, I don't self-diagnose as much because I'm the ultimate optimist. And so I don't want to think I have anything.
I'm just going to go ahead and point out, no disrespect to the Atlanta-based WebMD, but there's also other sites like the Mayo Clinic website, which I think is really, really strong, too. It's Friday. We're in the Bake Room talking about the week's news. I'll mention everybody's names here just in a minute. Coming up next, we'll talk about why debates about fact or fiction have turned into shouting matches. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Argusia, in for Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We're hanging out in the break room this morning talking about the week's news with Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia, Tamika DePriest, senior director of communications at Emory University, Stefan Turkheimer, the lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll, and also with us is Amy Condon down in Savannah. She's the associate editor for Savannah Magazine. And we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Well, this month, Georgia has declared a level one drought after a very dry summer. At least the second half of the summer was pretty darn dry. State wants to limit water used outdoors during the day. If you sprinkle your lawn during the day, you're going to lose most of it to evaporation anyway. Just a bad investment. This means that cars might get a little bit dirtier, lawns could turn slightly browner. Water shortages are nothing new in Georgia. And Atlanta gang, I wonder if that's part of the problem here in terms of getting people to observe water shortage recommendations. Like, Atlanta knows from drought. You've seen serious drought, and this just isn't as bad as it's been in years past, right? Not yet, at least.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. You don't have the nightly warnings on the news about how you should not drink any water and try to sort of desiccate yourself personally and get yourself through the day. We don't have that. We don't have Monica Kaufman out there accosting people as they try to water their lawns. And without that, you sort of don't think, well, this is like an orange alert. As someone who doesn't have a lawn myself, I feel, you know, I try to make up for it by taking like really long showers and doing all the things that are necessary to play my part in this Georgia effort to keep the drought going.
Yeah.
Well, I think if you drive by my house at this point, you definitely will see some brown. So I guess I'm participating in the conservation movement, you know, in an indirect way because I'm not watering the grass.
Oh, I see. You're doing it kind of passively, right?
Yeah. Like passively, indeed. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I try to regularly turn the water off while brushing my teeth. Mm-hmm. So maybe that counts as active.
Nice work.
Yeah. I could come on and say that, you know, I haven't been watering my lawn. But that's really not different than any other time. So I would look like some kind of water crusader when I'm really not. But
Amy, is stuff brown down in Savannah?
Yes, but that's because I'm really passive at taking care of my plants and things like that. If you want to kill something green, I'm great at it.
Well, so, put it in your lawn. Yeah, you got that.
Put it in my lawn. Because I have people come by all the time and go, do you need me to take care of this for you? And I'm like, no. Really, I'll get to it.
I will say that, like, so my folks came up and visited me in Macon the other week, and they flew into Savannah instead of flying into Atlanta, and they drove I-16 from Savannah up to Macon. And I told my dad, get really, really excited because he's a plant guy. And I was like, you know, I-16 from Savannah to Macon, there's nowhere to eat, but there's like nonstop crepe myrtle as far as the eye can see along that highway corridor. And it's like candy colored, you know, fantasy, you know, yellow brick road kind of thing. And like he got up there and they were all dead. They only started to get, I mean, not dead, but the flowers had passed probably a little bit earlier than they should have. They only started to see some flowers toward when he got toward Macon, and he was very disappointed. So everybody feel bad for Dad. Anyways, let's talk about something
a little more important.
If this year's political season is any indication, it seems that facts are not as important as they used to be. Debates and arguments seem to be completely ignorant of the truth oftentimes and focusing solely on feelings and personal opinions.
That's where the truth lies, right down here in the gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your gut than you have in your head? You can look it up. Now I know some of you are going to say I did look it up, and that's not true. That's because you looked it up in a book. Next time, look it up in your gut.
Immortal Colbert. Now, we've got author Mark Thompson saying that the truth is no longer important in our society. He writes that Americans now believe that everything is up for interpretation, no matter what the facts might tell us. So the question is, have we given up on truth? Amy, fellow journalist, tell me the answer is no.
No. We were talking about that here earlier because we were like, how do we package the truth where people will take it, you know? Do we have to do a better job almost of marketing the truth? I know that sounds like really cynical, but there's got to be a way of getting facts out there and keeping informed where people don't just shut down on it because, and I don't know if that's a delivery or how you present it, but no, we cannot give up on rational thought and making decisions based on good judgment.
No, I would hope that we would not give up on that. But, Stefan, I wonder if maybe part of what's going on here is that with the proliferation of more and more news organizations and sources of information, whether it be Georgia Poll or Breitbart or any number of gajillion things, I wonder if it's not so much that people don't care about facts anymore, but people have actually gotten better at scrutinizing facts. Back in the day when it was just Walter Cronkite telling you what's what and you really had no way to challenge or scrutinize what he was telling you, it seemed really easy to agree on a common set of facts. And in fact, what is a fact is often a lot more slippery than people realize. There's lots of shades of truth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And most of those websites you're referring to, I noticed you left out the adjective terrible in front of them, but you could have put it back in because, like,
in front
most
of your
them,
publication?
Wait, is that an opinion?
It's a fact, but it's also an opinion. The reality is, there's this proliferation of sort of Facebook-ready news sites that are, take headlines and make them just a little better, right? And just take facts and make them just a little better. And as they push it to the extremes, people start trusting them less and less. I mean, part of the problem isn't necessarily that people don't want the facts. It's that they don't trust the person telling them. And that's part of the issue here, because there's been a lack of faith in, say, mainstream media. And I don't know that it's necessarily a flight to those other sites. Maybe it is. But if you can achieve someone telling you the opinion you already believe, that's what you want in your news site to some degree. And that's kind of the problem that we've got.
But Tamika, is there not some benefit in getting away from the mono-narrative culture, right, and having lots of different versions of the story?
Well, I was just thinking about the satire, sensationalism, the desire for infotainment, and, that mix as it relates to news in terms of, some of these sites that Stefan mentioned. But I also was thinking about this penchant in society for disregarding facts. So, for example, I think of Trump's argument that President Obama was not born in America, right?
Mm-hmm. And which his campaign now says he doesn't believe, but he won't say that he doesn't believe it.
Right. And then, this segment of the population that even after producing, this birth certificate, right, and the detailed one, that, dismisses it. So it's a really, really weird dynamic coming from both sides in terms of what we're seeing in the news landscape and how journalism has evolved in some ways, and then yet to how the culture of society has changed in terms of rhetoric and what we take for fact versus non-fact.
biscuits are delicious. That's a fact.
that is a fact.
I think they make you happy and don't cause cancer.
They
probably do cause cancer. Sorry.
The facts you want to believe are the best ones.
Oh, those are the best ones to believe. And you got to factor in, you know, we're 20 years out from a president on TV, you know, discussing the definition of is. And now we're into the birthers and the truthers and all of these other bunches. You know, your own personal truth. Okay. What is the real truth? A lot of times truth is going to be a black and white issue, not racially, but just it is either true or it's not. I mean, that's it. But, you know, as Stefan said, you make a story better. You make it where you can sell it to your demographic that you're trying to reach, and there you go.
Or shape a point of view.
Yeah.
Or yeah, right.
Or both.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All very true. I'm just going to say that certainly my experience as a journalist has been a one long education in epistemology, the nature of knowledge. And it is often the case, I find, that we actually don't know a lot of the things that we think we know. The truth is much more elusive than I think that people realize. Sam Burnham is the curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. He was the last person we heard there. He's with our break room gang. Also with him is Tamika DePriest. She's the senior director of communications at Emory University. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. And down in Savannah is Amy Condon, associate editor for Savannah Magazine. They are our break room gang, and we're talking about the week's news here on Fridays on Second Thought. Go ahead and move on to interesting story out of Detroit. Students from Detroit Public Schools have filed a lawsuit against the state's education system. Their goal is to make literacy a constitutional right for all students, not just access to education, but the outcome, literacy, making that a right for all students. They argue that students at low-performing schools are denied their basic right to literacy, and the government should be held accountable. This could become a groundbreaking case as it attempts to establish just a new concept for the already established constitutional right to an education. Do we think that American children have a right to literacy? Anybody eager to jump on this?
Yes.
I do.
Yeah. Sure.
Let's go to Tamika first.
Yes, children have a right to literacy. So that's out of the way. The underfunding of...
okay.
You know, out of the way. But
no supporting arguments there?
But the underfunding of education in inner cities is a long-term issue, and Detroit demonstrates what happens when, you know, we don't have any mechanisms to address it. And, you know, at a time when we can figure out how to, you know, increase our tax base to get billion-dollar stadiums in cities... we can't figure out how to make sure our children are educated. So,
but
you can't
Amy,
be an
go ahead, pick it up.
You can't be an active participant in democracy if you are illiterate because you can't read. It affects your ability to work. It affects your ability to engage. Democracy really depends on having people who can actively participate, and it goes back to if you're underfunding education and you don't have literacy as an absolute requirement to move on and progress, then you are actually taking an entire segment of society and discounting their participation in that society.
No doubt literacy is essential. However, Sam, can the government really guarantee the outcome that a child will be able to read? Instead, I mean, can't all government do is guarantee the ability the chance to learn how to read?
Right. The government cannot guarantee that.
But they can put teachers in the classroom. Well, they can pay for.
Put the teachers in the classrooms, give the kids the materials that they need, give them every opportunity, and then, you know, as Amy was just mentioning, be involved as a student. Do your due diligence to achieve literacy. You know, you can't just open a slot in somebody's head and pour education in it. It's something that has to be earned. They have to want it. They have to...
I'm pretty sure we're all going
to
get a lightning port soon, and that's going to be the only way in. But
right.
Anyway.
No, they're going to remove that.
They're going to take that one out, too?
Only some people are going to get it. I mean, because that's kind of the issue, right? Because it's like you've got this their argument is it's not that everybody's not trying. They're not that all the schools aren't trying to make people literate. It's that some people have the necessary resources to do it, and some people don't. And their entire lawsuit is an equal protection suit. They're trying to determine whether or not there's a discrete group of plaintiffs that are being discriminated against, essentially, in a disparate educational environment. And that's the whole nature of this is this group of Michigan plaintiffs a discrete group? Can they fall under equal protection? And that's what's so interesting.
Well, thanks for lawyering the fun out of that one.
Sorry.
We got like 2 minutes. I want to try to get one more education topic in here. There's this ongoing debate in Canada about class curriculum. A Muslim father has determined that his kids should be exempted from a music class on religious grounds. The school refused to grant the request and told the family that music is an essential part of the learning process. Question here is, should parents be allowed to keep their kids out of certain classes in public school? Parents have been able to opt their kids out of other kinds of instruction on religious grounds, like sex ed. Is music in the same category? How do we feel?
I think the arts and music, I think it's very important to our culture. I think it helps us to form our identity. I think it's important. But again, if you've let kids out of other classes, then I think they have a case.
Man, no. Listen, okay, I understand there's music literacy, but look, that music literacy, all of it. It's important. And you don't get to pick and choose the curriculum. We're all in this
exactly.
together. This is school. This is indoctrination into our society. We need to make it happen. I know that sounds sarcastic, but I'm being serious.
I'm with you on that. But have you let someone else out of another class?
Have I personally? No. Everyone has to go to all the classes. Look, this is the thing. We're in this together. We can't do this whole pick and choose. This isn't a buffet.
Right.
This is a price-fixed dinner that we've already paid for.
I'm with you, but you got to be the lawyer for the defense on this one at some point.
We're also talking about Canada, where, you know, which is basically descended of British common law, and the concept of freedom of religious expression is enshrined in that system, but not as kind of ironclad as it is in ours. Tamika, if someone says music is not okay in my religion, who is the government to say otherwise?
I think that's a tough question, especially, you know, when there's precedent for allowing, you know, these opt-outs based on, I mean, you can make a religious argument to opt out of many kinds of courses. And so, you know, I think it's opening a Pandora's box. So, I agree with Stefan. I'm the product of, you know, sort of an educational perspective that, you know, is centered around well-roundedness. And so you got to have music and from, you know, you need sex education, you know, when and
that often goes hand in hand with music.
Yeah, there you go. You know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Well, okay,
we're not going to top that.
We're
not going to top that. Let's leave it there.
Well, you got. Don't forget about the Canadians and their 55-yard line and no fourth down. I mean, we're talking about Canadians here. So.
And those tiny hard biscuits that we can't call biscuits.
Yeah.
But their prime minister was holding pandas today.
All right, calm down.
They were almost as cute as him.
Exactly.
Amy Condon is the associate editor of Savannah Magazine. Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Tamika DePriest is a director of communications at Emory University. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor of Georgia Poll. It was a lot of fun, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend.